If you go out into the country far away from the big city lights and you look upon a clear winter night, you know, it's very easy to affirm what the psalmist said, what King David wrote. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament, or the expanse, shows his handiwork. I mean, that seems so obvious, right? But we're being told that that's not the case. We're being told that our universe, rather than being God's handiwork, is the result of a cosmic accident, a explosion, if you will, that they call the Big Bang. And the Big Bang has a lot of problems. We could spend an entire talk just on problems with the Big Bang model. One of the problems is that they have a hard time explaining where stars come from. And, you know, last time I checked, there's a whole lot of stars out there. So if you're trying to explain the origin of the universe and you can't explain stars, you've got a problem. Now, they do have a theory, if you will. They claim that these stars formed from these giant gas clouds way out in space. The problem is gas tends to expand, and if you're going to make a star out of gas, somehow you got to compress the gas, and it's got to be compressed enough so that gravity can take over, and the gravity can compress it still further so that nuclear fusion can start. So you know, you don't see any giant pistons out in space to press the gas together. So how do you compress the gas? Well, they would often say sometimes that it's a shock from an exploding star, okay? Well, can you see a potential problem with that explanation? Okay, if your explanation for where stars come from requires stars to already be in existence, that doesn't work very well, right? But that's what they say. So I want to show you in the next frame what our universe would look like if the Big Bang were true, what you would see up in the night sky. Now, don't blink. This is a very exciting slide. That's what you would see, okay? There wouldn't be any stars, okay? If the Big Bang were true, there wouldn't be any stars, okay? So the very fact that these stars exist testify against the Big Bang. Now, say a big part of this Big Bang story is that the universe is around 14 billion years old, but Scripture teaches that the Earth is young. Not just the Earth, but the universe is young. If you add up the genealogies, those numbers in the genealogies, you get an age of about 6,000 years. And of course, this immediately raises the question when you've got this conflict from what secular scientists are saying and what the Bible says. Some Christians start to wonder, well, is the Bible wrong? Well, I want to assure you this afternoon it's not wrong. And I want to also assure you that recent creation is reasonable. Despite what people may try to tell you, you are not committing intellectual suicide by affirming a recent creation. And so there's three big points I want to make here. First, this may surprise you, but science cannot prove that the universe is old or young. And the reason for that is pretty simple, okay? Age is not something you can measure in a laboratory. There is no device, no tricorder out there that can measure age. Every time you get an age, that it's always a calculated number based on assumptions about the past. And those estimates, those age estimates, are only as good as the assumptions behind them. And the problem is that creation and secular scientists have very different starting assumptions. Okay, we affirm creation in a global flood, and they deny those things. And they hold to a philosophy called uniformitarianism. You're going to hear that word again. But it's summarized by the motto that the present is the key to the past. And so they say that Earth history is explainable by things that are going on today, processes that are going on today operating at pretty much the same rates and intensities that they do today. And they would say the same thing for the universe. So a uniformitarian geologist would say that since erosion today is slow, it's always been slow. And he would argue that the Grand Canyon was slowly carved out over millions of years. So science can't prove the universe is old or young because those are all calculated ages based on assumptions about the past. However, what we're going to see is even when you make uniformitarian assumptions, most age estimates, in fact, nearly all of them, are consistent with biblical creation, but not with the Big Bang story. Now, what do I mean by that? Uniformitarian is wrong, but even when you make generous assumptions, assumptions that are very favorable to uniformitarianism, you know, you can get age ranges for distant space objects. And when you do that, the maximum ages are much too young for the Big Bang story. Now, some of these are still in millions or even billions of years, but they're way too young to fit comfortably with a Big Bang story. And because those are maximum possible ages, the true ages could be just 6,000 years. For instance, if you look at spiral galaxies, secular scientists will tell you that they're more than 10 billion years old. But we're going to see later in this talk, Lord willing, that there's reasons to believe they can't be anywhere near that old. Depending on which the assumptions you make, you know, they could maybe be at most maybe a few hundred million years old, or even maybe you could push it out to 5 billion years, but there's no way they can be as old as what we're being told. And but because that's those are maximum age estimates, okay, the true age could just be 6,000 years. Now, of course, I know what some people are going to say, right? Okay, the question we always get is, okay, well, what about distant starlight, okay? How do you young Earth creationists explain distant starlight? And I will freely admit, I don't know. But I will tell you this. Those who think that this is a slam dunk argument for an old universe are really oversimplifying things. And to try to give you a feel for why you shouldn't be intimidated by this, I want to point out that the behavior of light is really strange. Okay, it's totally counterintuitive. Now, you've probably read that it's 186,000 miles per second, and that's true. But here's what's weird about it. That's the speed of light is always the same, regardless of whether the light source is standing still, whether it's moving toward you, or whether it's moving away from you. So let's use an analogy. Let's say that you're standing on the side of the road, and there's a car coming toward you at 50 miles an hour. And let's say you have a professional baseball pitcher sitting in the passenger seat, and they open the sunroof, and he throws a fastball at 100 miles an hour. Okay, so how fast are you going to see that ball coming toward you? The car's moving at 50 miles an hour. You got 100 miles per hour for the ball. What's the speed going to be? 150, right? You just add them together, right? Okay. And if, for instance, let's say if the car was moving still toward you at 50 miles an hour, let's say he turns around and throws the ball at 50 miles an hour in the other direction, what's the speed going to be? Zero. To you, it's going to look like it's standing still, right? Okay, well, let's do that same illustration with a spaceship. So let's say you've got a spaceship that's traveling at almost the speed of light. Somehow they've got warp drive technology. They're almost at the speed of light. And that ship fires a laser at you. Now, you would be tempted to say, right, the speed of the light ought to be, well, if the ship's moving at just almost the speed of light and the light's coming at you at the speed of light, shouldn't the speed be twice 186,000 miles per second? That's what you would intuitively think. No, it's still 186,000 miles per second. And even if the ship is moving away from you at almost the speed of light and it shoots a laser at you, that laser, you're going to still see it coming toward you at 186,000 miles per second. So the speed of light is weird to begin with. And so what that ought to tell us is that, you know, maybe this is a little more complicated than people think it is. And that fact about the speed of light is one thing that led to Einstein's theory of relativity. And this is where you get these weird effects such as clocks ticking at different rates depending on speed and gravity. Now, a lot of creationists think this may be the way you explain distant starlight. In fact, there are creationists out there who think the problem has already been solved. Okay, I'm not an expert in that area, so I can't be too dogmatic about that. But I can tell you this is not the kind of thing you ought to be intimidated by. Now, the third point here, how many of you have ever heard that creationists never make predictions? Okay, well, I've heard it. Okay, they tell us that a lot. It's not true. And what I want to show you this afternoon is how a physicist, not me, but another creation physicist, took biblical young universe assumptions and made a whole bunch of successful predictions about the magnetism of bodies in our solar system. So we're going to go ahead and start on this tour, okay, and we're going to kind of look at our solar system and then a little bit beyond it. So we're going to start outside our Milky Way galaxy, and we're going to zoom in, fly in toward our solar system. And you can see the sun there, okay? And secular scientists claim that the sun formed from a rotating cloud of gas and dust. Now, we're going to see there's lots of problems with that idea, but this isn't the case, okay? God made the sun, and our sun is very well behaved. Okay, there are other stars out there that are similar to our sun that will sometimes emit these violent blasts of radiation. And if our sun did that, let's just say it would ruin our day, okay? That would be really bad news. Okay, so we should be very grateful that God designed our sun so well. You know, a lot of secular scientists say, oh, our sun is just an average, mediocre star. The more we're learning, the more we're realizing that's not true at all. It's actually very special. But our sun also presents a problem for those who claim that it's billions of years old. And there's a little problem that the evolutionists have called the young, faint sun paradox. And strangely enough, Carl Sagan, who was always trying to convince us of billions and billions of years, was one of the people who pointed this out. And based on their ideas about stellar evolution, they think billions of years ago, the sun should have been a lot dimmer than it is today. And as a result, the Earth would have gotten a lot less sunlight, and so the Earth would have basically been frozen. Now, the problem for them is that evolutionists think, well, no, that's not right. Billions of years ago, when life was just getting started, the Earth was warm. So what you have is you have one part of the evolutionary story contradicting another part of the evolutionary story. And biblical creationists don't have that problem because we don't expect there to be a dramatic change in the intensity of sunlight in just a few thousand years. But every now and then you will see articles online claiming they solved this problem. Like here's one from 2010. But then they said, oops, not so fast. 1 year later, they admitted they didn't quite have it solved. Then back in 2015, they're still working on it or thinking maybe they solved it. And then I think in 2016, they're still working. You get the idea, right? Okay, so when you see these people claiming they've solved this problem, just keep in mind, they claimed that before and it turned out not to be the case. This is a very real problem for them. So we're going to move on from the sun, and we're going to go to the innermost planet in the solar system, Mercury. It's just a hunch I have, but how much do you want to bet that when the Lord comes back, he's probably going to make us change the names of these planets? It's a hunch I have. But let me tell you, Mercury is a problem for people who believe in billions of years. There are hints that it's young. It has a magnetic field. And one of the reasons this is a problem for secular scientists is we're going to talk about this a little bit later, they've got a dynamo theory to try to explain how moons and planets can have magnetic fields that last for billions of years. Now, in order for this theory, the theory has a lot of problems. It doesn't work, but one of the things it has to have is you have to have a molten core, okay? You have to have a liquid core. Now, the Earth does have a liquid core, okay? But we've also got the innermost core is solid. And creationists think you can have a magnetic field without a liquid core, but evolutionists think you absolutely have to have a liquid core in order to have a magnetic field. Okay, so why is this a problem? Well, the problem is that Mercury is so small that it should have cooled off eons ago, and all that liquid core should have solidified. It should have frozen. So how can Mercury have a magnetic field? If you're an evolutionist and you think you have to have a liquid core in order to have a magnetic field, how do you explain Mercury? Okay, it's a problem for them. Now, on the other hand, Russ Humphreys, who's a respected creation physicist, he predicted way back in 1984 that older volcanic or igneous rocks from Mercury ought to have some of their earlier magnetization locked in. There should be a record of that original magnetism. And sure enough, when the Messenger spacecraft flew by a few years ago, that turned out to be the case. Now, of course, they're claiming those rocks are 3.8 billion years old. We don't accept those numbers. But these are older rocks on Mercury. He also predicted that there's a quantity that you call the magnetic dipole moment, and it's a number, and if you know that number, you can figure out how big the biggest part of the magnetic field is. But he predicted that between 1975 and 2011, it would drop between 4 and 6%. Now, he didn't get it exactly right. It turned out it actually dropped by about 8%. But see, this is a price. An evolutionist would have expected Mercury not to even have a magnetic field or a magnetic dipole moment to begin with. So that's a big change in just, say, 25 or 30 years or so. Okay, that's really shocking for secular scientists. So we're going to move on from Mercury, and we're going to approach a comet here. And comets are also a problem because every time they come near the sun, they lose some matter. Some of those ices on the nucleus of the comet vaporize, and you get these nice pretty tails, But they're kind of like ice cream cones, okay? Every time they come near the sun, they're losing mass. And so the question is, why are they still visible? According to secular science, these comets are leftovers from the formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. Well, why do we still see comets? Now, they're well aware of this problem, and they will tell you that there are reservoirs of potential comets out there that can restock the supply of comets. There's something called the Kuiper Belt or the Scattered Disk, and there's something called the Oort Cloud, and they would argue that this supplies new comets. Well, the problem about this is that there's different kinds of comets. Some of them have short periods. They go around the sun in 200 years or less, and others have longer orbital periods, and they have different characteristics. And so what they really need is multiple reservoirs to try to make this work. And just their theory of comets has gotten so complicated, it's really hard to keep up with. But let me just show you this one example of the kind of problem they're having. Okay, they're now claiming that they would argue that the Halley-type comets, those are the comets that have orbital characteristics like Halley's Comet, came from something called the scattered disk, okay? You may have heard people talk about something called the Kuiper Belt. There is a belt of objects out there that they would call the Kuiper Belt, but the problem is it doesn't have enough stuff in it, okay? And there's other problems as well. So there's like 10 times less mass than you would need to make this work. So some of these secular scientists said, okay, well, maybe these Halley-type comets are coming from the Oort Cloud. Okay, well, what's one problem with that? Well, one is there's not a shred of evidence the Oort Cloud even exists. Okay, the late Carl Sagan acknowledged that. So the bottom line is that these supposed reservoirs to restock the comets just don't work very well. So comets are a valid argument for recent creation. Okay, now we're going to move on to the second planet, which is Venus. And Venus also is a problem for them. Remember, they think that the sun formed from a rotating cloud of gas and dust. They think that's true of the entire solar system. If that were true, you would expect all the planets to be orbiting the same way, but they don't. Venus actually spins backwards, and that's a problem for their secular theory. The surface of Venus also looks young. There's recent lava flows. There's not a whole lot of craters on Venus, but they're kind of distributed uniformly. And for that reason, a lot of secular scientists have concluded that the surface of Venus has to be relatively young. They would say maybe between 700 million and a billion years old. But they don't like that because that implies that there was some kind of catastrophe that resurfaced pretty much the entire planet. And uniformitarians don't like that. They don't like the idea of a catastrophe on Venus. And I think the reason for that is if you need catastrophism to explain the geology on Venus, you may also need catastrophism to explain the geology on Earth. And what if that geology also requires a lot of water? Okay, you can probably see where this is going. So we're going to go to the next planet, and I sure hope everybody recognizes this one. Okay, it should look pretty familiar. Okay, Earth, right? And one thing we can say about the Earth, just as a quick overview, obviously it's well designed for life, but 71% of the Earth's surface is underwater. Most of the land surface is covered by sedimentary rocks, and even evolutionists will admit nearly all of those are water deposited. They will try to argue that a lot of them were deposited under tranquil conditions, but there's increasing evidence that that claim is wrong. But these are water deposited, and within those water deposited rocks, you got billions of fossilized plants and animals. And so we're arguing that when you see these strata in the Grand Canyon, what you're really seeing is not evidence for millions of years, but you're seeing evidence for the flood. Okay, so obviously if the flood really happened, that strongly suggests the Earth is young. But we can also look, the rocks and fossils, if they really were formed during the flood 4,500 years ago, where's the evidence for millions of years? The Earth's magnetic field is also a problem if you believe in billions of years. Secular scientists have been trying to explain for over a century how the Earth's magnetic field could be maintained for billions of years. You see, all magnetic fields are driven by electrical currents. Okay, so the problem is you got to keep that electrical current going for billions of years. And you would normally think, well, maybe the current will just gradually die down. Okay, that's what you would expect. And creationists don't have any problem with that, because if it was gradually dying down, you could still have a magnetic field after just 6,000 years. But if you're trying to maintain the magnetic field for billions of years, you need a complicated way to try to keep that going. And they call it the dynamo theory. They've got no idea how to make it work. In fact, a geophysicist just about 5 years ago said, we have no idea how the Earth's magnetic field has lasted for billions of years. In fact, he said, we understand less now than we thought we did 10 years ago. And it's actually worse than that, because if you look at the rate at which Earth's energy, the energy of the magnetic field is decreasing, and you extrapolate backwards, the magnetic field could really only be thousands of years old. Because even just tens of thousands of years into the past, the current would have been so large that it would have melted the crust and melted the mantle. Okay, so that is a strong argument for recent creation. And by the way, Russell Humphreys made another successful prediction that volcanic rocks would show evidence of rapid magnetic reversals. Now, magnetic reversal is where the north and south magnetic poles flip places, trade places, and creationists think there were magnetic reversals, but we think those are associated with the Genesis flood. And he suggested that if that was caused by the flood, it ought to happen really fast. And he suggested they would find evidence that the reversals happened within just a few weeks. Because you would see within a single rock evidence that the field had changed directions. Because it only takes maybe a few weeks for that lava to solidify. Well, sure enough, they actually found evidence for that. And it was confirmed. And even the secular scientists now are saying, well, yeah, it looks like we had a fairly rapid magnetic change. But this was something that really surprised them, okay? And it was, again, another successful prediction that Russ Humphreys made. Well, we're going to go on to our nearest neighbor in space. That's the moon. And evolutionary scientists have a very hard time explaining the moon's existence. In fact, one Harvard astrophysicist once is reported to have said, he said, basically, the best explanation for the moon is observational error. The moon doesn't exist. Okay, so I don't know what's going on there. I don't know if the moon's playing peekaboo with us or what. Maybe the moon's not really there when nobody's looking. But they have a hard time explaining where it came from. And there's a lot of evidence that the moon is young. For instance, you have these things on the moon called scarps. These are the embankments that you see. And if you look in this picture right here, that's the scarp right there. Okay? Well, there are clues that those scarps happened fairly recently, because you will sometimes see small craters that have been distorted. Okay, for instance, right here, you can see that crater's been distorted. Small craters are thought to be relatively recent, because if they were older, other meteorite impacts would have obliterated and destroyed them. So the smaller craters are thought to be fairly recent. And so if those small craters got distorted by this uplift, that must have been fairly recent too. And they're now saying they think what's happening is that the moon is actually, the crust is actually shrinking as it cools off. And of course, that just blew the secular scientists away. One of the scientists who was involved in that research said the whole idea that a 4.6 billion year old rocky body like the moon has managed to stay hot enough in the interior and produce this network of faults just flies in the face of conventional wisdom. Okay? These bodies ought to be losing heat more rapidly than that, especially small bodies. They ought to be cooling off fairly rapidly. So they were blown away by the idea that the moon could still have enough energy that it's actually cooling off. You also have things called transient lunar phenomena, where sometimes you will see flashes of light on the moon. Those are kind of controversial, but there was one that happened not too long ago that was very well documented. And some of these might be meteorite impacts, but some people think this could be evidence of continuing geological activity. And yet for many years, the evolutionary scientists said the sun had been geologically dead for the last 3 billion years. Furthermore, the moon has evidence in its rocks that it once had a strong magnetic field, and that's tough for them to explain. It's hard enough to explain Earth having a magnetic field for billions of years. It's even harder for the moon. And so these are all things that indicate that the moon is relatively young. Now we go to the red planet, okay, Mars. There's a lot of interesting things we could say about Mars. There's no evidence of life on Mars. And a lot of secular scientists want very badly to find life in outer space, because they think that somehow that will make the evolutionary story seem more plausible. But also, there's evidence of catastrophic flooding on Mars, and creationists don't have any problem with that at all. But here's what's kind of weird. Evolutionists are willing to accept catastrophic flooding on Mars. Today, there's not a drop of liquid water on the planet. But on our planet, which is basically a water world, they say, oh, there's no evidence for a worldwide flood. That seems a little inconsistent to me. And it just illustrates the saying that, you know, people will believe anything so long as it's not in the Bible. So we think that's interesting how they're kind of inconsistent there. Also, Russ Humphreys again predicted that the older volcanic rocks on Mars should also have a record of their magnetization, and sure enough, they found that as well. Again, we don't accept those age estimates of billions of years, but older volcanic rocks do have that remnant magnetization in them. Okay, now we're going to go to the outer planets, and we're coming up on Jupiter, which is famous for being the largest planet. And Jupiter is losing energy very rapidly, okay? It gives off twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. So it ought to be cooling off pretty quickly. It's kind of like a potato that you've taken out of the microwave. It's going to stay warm for a while, but eventually it's going to cool off. And so the question is, if Jupiter's billions of years old, why is it still warm? But it could still be warm after just 6,000 years. Now, secular scientists, again, they're aware of this problem. They've come up with a number of ideas to try to explain how Jupiter could be warm after billions of years. They've all got problems. None of them really work. The simplest explanation is that Jupiter's just young. It's still cooling off from that heat that God gave it 6,000 years ago. Now, the moons of Jupiter also provide evidence of youth. This is called Io. It's the most volcanically active body in the solar system. Kind of looks like a pizza. The reason this is a problem is, how do you have volcanic activity after billions of years? Because that requires energy. You need energy to drive that volcanism. Now, when they deal with this issue, the thing they always invoke is something called tidal flexing, where you can have gravitational tugs kind of pulling on and pushing on the crust and heating it up. And that might just barely work for Io, but they would have to have some things, I think, go their way. And they have to make some assumptions about the interior of Io that we really don't know to be the case. The simplest explanation is that it's young. And there's other examples where that explanation of tidal flexing doesn't work very well. This is Ganymede. It's also one of Jupiter's moons, and it has a magnetic field. Guess what? That also bugs secular scientists for the same reason that Mercury's magnetic field bugs them. Because little bitty Ganymede should have cooled off eons ago. Its core, if it had a liquid core, it should have frozen, and you shouldn't have a magnetic field, but it does. And by the way, the tidal flexing is harder to make this work because Ganymede's farther out. Okay, so the gravitational tugs are weaker on it than on Io. So again, if Ganymede is billions of years old, its magnetic field should have disappeared long ago. But if it's just 6,000 years, it could still have a magnetic field, because that electrical current that God initially started, it's still going. It's gotten a lot weaker, but it's still going. It's still there. Now we go on to the ringed planet. That's Saturn. Those rings are just gorgeously beautiful. I got to see them in a telescope not that long ago for the first time. First time I did it myself. Okay, I'm a little embarrassed to say this as a PhD physicist. I haven't really done much astronomy, but I got me a telescope for last Christmas, and I was able to see Saturn's rings, and it was really cool. It was really neat. But the rings are a problem for evolutionists because they look young. Those rings are made up of little particles of ice. And as Saturn moves through space, those ice particles are being pelted by meteorite dust, okay? And so they ought to get sooty. They ought to look dark and dirty after billions of years. And recently, based on data that they obtained from the Cassini mission, they said, look, these rings can only be at most between 150 and 300 million years old. He said, there's not much you can do about it. It has to be young. Now, I think some more recent measurements whittle that number down to like 100 million. So could they be just 6,000 years old? Yes, because those are upper age limits. Those rings really do look young. Also, one of Saturn's moons, Titan, it has an atmosphere, and that's interesting because some of that atmosphere consists of methane. And there's ultraviolet radiation that destroys the methane in the atmosphere, but there's no evidence that the methane is being replenished. Okay, so the maximum possible age for Titan's atmosphere is about 10 to 100 million years. Again, that's a maximum age. So could the true age be just 6,000 years? Yes. You know, if you're an evolutionist, you want Titan to be a lot older than that. Okay. Same thing for Saturn's rings. You know, you could argue maybe Saturn's rings formed after the formation of the planet Saturn. Maybe the rings are young, but the planet Saturn is old. But they don't like that because that's harder for them to explain. It would be easier for them to have Saturn's rings form at the same time as the planet. Okay, now we're going to go out to Uranus. And there's some interesting things we could say about Uranus. Uranus is tilted sideways, okay? Unlike the other planets spin like a top. This rolls like a wheel on the ground. That, again, is a problem for this idea that the solar system formed from this rotating cloud of gas and dust, because you would expect everything to be rotating the same way. Now, Russ Humphreys, before the Voyager 2 space probe flew by Uranus, he predicted that the magnetic moment would be a certain number, and guess what? He was right. Okay, he couldn't make an exact prediction because he didn't have enough data, but he predicted it would be somewhere around what you call 1 followed by 24 amps meters squared. That's the unit for a magnetic dipole moment, and sure enough, when Voyager 2 flew by 2 years later, it was in that ballpark. It was 3 times 10 to the 24th amps meters squared. And the reason he did this was because he took 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5 seriously, where it says that God, the earth was standing out of the water and in the water. And he argued that God made the heavenly bodies out of water. And that enabled him to make some successful predictions. But we're also going to go to Neptune. Neptune is interesting as well. Like Jupiter, it's radiating a lot of energy. So how does it stay warm for billions of years? Again, Russ Humphreys predicted that the magnetic dipole moment for Neptune would be about the same as it was for Uranus, and sure enough, he was right. Now, you may be wondering, well, how do secular scientists do? How are their predictions on the magnetic fields of the planets doing? Well, this is what one scientist said back in 1989. You would have thought we would have given up guessing about planetary magnetic fields after being wrong at nearly every planet in the solar system. Okay, so they don't have a very good track record. Okay, they don't have a very good track record. Okay, now we're going to fly on to Pluto. Now, Pluto's not technically a planet anymore. It got demoted. But Pluto is very interesting. When the New Horizons spacecraft flew by Pluto, we got a lot more data. And one thing that was very interesting is that Pluto turned out to be geologically active. And one secular scientist on the New Horizons science team said, well, he didn't think anybody would have expected that. Well, some of us creationists let's put it this way, we wouldn't be surprised by that. In fact, I wrote a little news article for ICR, and I think it was published the day it made its closest approach. It said, look, don't be surprised if there's stuff about Pluto that strongly suggests it's not billions of years old. Well, guess what? That's absolutely true. Okay, you know, you've all probably seen pictures of the heart-shaped region on Pluto. You know, this area, this right here, this lobe of that heart, there's not a single crater. And for that reason, secular scientists think the age has to be less than 10 million years. And the reason for that is it looks like this part of the planet got resurfaced somehow. Because after millions of years, you ought to see some craters, right? In fact, even from a creation perspective, after 6,000 years, you probably ought to see some craters. So obviously something resurfaced this part of Pluto. The problem with that implies geological activity, and geological activity takes heat. And this is what one scientist said. But New Horizons revealed an active surface on an old planet, and internal heating is the best current guess for what's driving that activity, even if scientists don't quite know how that heat has lasted for 4 billion years. Okay, the billions of years are the problem. Okay, there's a lot of stuff about the solar system that if you just strip away that assumption, it starts to really make a lot more sense. Now we're going to fly outside our Milky Way galaxy again. And like other Milky Way galaxies, it's slowly spinning, but the parts don't necessarily spin at the same rate. Parts that are closer should be spinning faster, and as a result, spiral pattern should be distorted over millions of years. So you know over time this galaxy is going to be more and more distorted. Eventually, you probably wouldn't see any kind of spiral pattern at all. It would just become this smeared out disk. And you should certainly start noticing this after a few hundred million years. And after about 5 billion years, you really shouldn't be able to see any pattern at all. It'd all just be a disk. So if these spiral galaxies really are billions of years old, more than 10 billion years old in a lot of cases, well, why do they look like this and not this? So the spiral galaxies are strong evidence for recent creation. Now, they will try to tell you they've got a theory to explain this. They call it the spiral density wave theory. Take it with a grain of salt because they're still working on that theory, and they have admitted that there's stuff about the theory that doesn't make sense. It's hard for them to see how these waves could keep that spiral pattern going for billions of years. So if we fly to a particular location in our galaxy, we're going to come across this blue star. It's called Alnitak, and it's the lowermost star in Orion's belt, and it's a blue star. And these hot blue stars are interesting because they consume their nuclear fuel rapidly. Even when you make the standard secular assumptions, the blue stars should go through their nuclear fuel in maybe sometimes hundreds of billions of years, tens of millions of years. The very hottest ones should burn out in just 3 million years or less. So why do we still see blue stars if the universe is billions of years old? Well, they would claim new stars are being formed, but there's lots of problems with their star formation theories, and we saw one of those problems earlier. So this is all evidence of youth, and I just thought it was neat here to kind of look at these beautiful images of what God has created. And there are countless stars out there, and yet God has counted them, and he has a name for every single one of them. So I hope this has been encouraging to you. Recent creation is reasonable. You're not committing intellectual suicide by holding to a recent creation, because science cannot prove that the universe is old or young, despite what some people on TV want you to think. Even when you make uniformitarian assumptions, most of these age estimates, nearly all of them, are consistent with biblical creation, but they're not consistent with the Big Bang. And by making biblical young universe assumptions, Russ Humphreys was able to make a whole bunch of successful predictions about the magnetism of bodies in our solar system. So we really shouldn't be surprised by this, right? Because the Lord Jesus himself affirmed a recent creation. As we saw earlier this morning, he said, but from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. And those other two verses that we also mentioned, where he implicitly affirms the doctrine of recent creation. So the universe did not come from a big bang. The Lord made it. And as the psalmist says, let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spake and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. These are some of the credits for some of the images that we used in this presentation. And we've got resources. I think we still have some of these space, God's majestic handiwork books out there. We've got a book dealing with the universe, Guide to the Universe, that has a lot of really good information. And we've got our DVD series, The Universe, A Journey Through God's Grand Design. Let me just show you a brief promo for that DVD series.
The history of astronomy is a story of discovery, a quest for knowledge. It's the story of mankind trying to get a glimpse into the mind of God. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Who created all this?
There's something in the human nature, and I would say it's because we bear the image of God, that seeks to understand the things around us.
Yeah, that was astronaut Jeff Colonel Jeff Williams, and he's a big ICR supporter. He's done events with us, and we're very grateful for his support of biblical creation. We've also got, again, we've got our magazine, Acts and Facts. Please, if you haven't signed up for it yet, please do so. It's absolutely free, and it has information that you can use every month to show how biblical creation is superior to the evolutionary story that they've been telling us. Thank you, and I hope this talk has been a blessing to you. Okay.